welcome to another Psych Matters podcast from the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. Psych Matters is a series of discussions on training and practice issues facing trainees and fellows at the college and other important topics in mental health. In this episode of Psych Matters, Professor Richard Harvey is in conversation with Professor David Castle and their guest, Associate Professor Lynette Averill from Baylor College of Medicine, Houston, and Yale School of Medicine, to discuss their perspectives on psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy in clinical practice.
We acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples as the First Nations and the traditional owners and custodians of the lands and waters known as Australia, and Māori as Tangata Whenua in Aotearoa. We honour and respect the elders past and present who weave their wisdom into all realms of life.
So welcome to the podcast from the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. I'm Richard Harvey. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice and I'm deputy chair of the Policy, Practice and Partnerships Committee at the college, and I'm also chairing the working group on psychedelics for the college. I'm joined today by Professor David Castle and Lynette Averill, and what we're hoping to do over the next sort of 30 to 40 minutes is have a discussion about our perspectives on psychedelic therapy, which is likely to be coming to Australia from the 1st of July. So I'm going to get my two guests to introduce themselves, and we might start with Lynette. Would you like to introduce yourself to us?
Sure, thank you, and thank you so much for the opportunity to join you today. Yeah, I am currently an associate professor at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas, have a position at the Department of Veterans Affairs there, and still an adjunct position at Yale and the National Center for PTSD. I suppose my role here and my area of expertise is really stress and trauma-related mental health concerns and novel interventions, specifically rapid-acting novel interventions. So I've done a lot of work with ketamine and now doing a lot of work with psychedelic medicine and assisted therapies. Very much heavy on the research side, but also working clinically with folks who generally have those treatment-resistant symptoms of depression, anxiety, PTSD, suicidality, et cetera, that really are not finding therapeutic benefit from our traditionally available interventions. And then within the last couple of years, have been very involved in advocacy and policy work that started when I served as subject matter expert for a piece of legislation in Texas that now supports a psilocybin trial for veterans with PTSD. I will be leading that study, and then that was the beginning of what has now snowballed into a lot of briefings and education and legislative conversations around how do we consider thoughtful policy and thoughtful infrastructure for the safe, effective use of psychedelic medicines and assisted therapies?
Thank you. David, I'm sure many people will know you, but I think it would be helpful to have you introduce yourself as well.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm a psychiatrist. I work currently in Tasmania. I trained in the UK and then I was in Melbourne for about 20 years and just came back from 2 years in Canada. So I have some perspectives from there as well around what's happened with the psychedelics. I do have great interest in the impact of licit and illicit substances on the mind, I suppose. So the excitement for me about the psychedelics has been about obviously clinical utility and whether we can blend it nicely with psychotherapy, which I think is a very nice sort of paradigm to use biological and psychological elements of our therapeutic armamentarium together. So that's one of the things. We have a number of trials just completed or just about to complete an open trial of treatment-resistant depression led by Swinburne Uni, and are just about to start a large 160-person multi-center trial, also led by Swinburne, in treatment-resistant depression, and very interested to go to other disorders, particularly obsessive-compulsive and related disorders, body dysmorphic disorder, anorexia nervosa, and psilocybin for PTSD. I think we should really get into, because most of the data has been on MDMA for PTSD thus far. So that's sort of how we're thinking, and hugely exciting times, but worrying times as well in terms of ensuring we get all this right and it doesn't blow up in our face.
So David, I wonder whether maybe we could start by you sort of summarizing what is going to be different from the 1st of July, particularly for people that haven't been exactly following what's been occurring?
I keep on saying, I never imagined in my life I would be critical of a government agency for acting too quickly. But in this scenario, I think the TGA has actually. It's not really, with all due respect to the individuals, hasn't really thought through the implications of this rescheduling. And that's partly why we have this podcast, I guess, is to share with listeners how the college is thinking about it. But the long and the short is the TGA, surprisingly to the field, obviously some people knew it was going to happen, announced that from the 1st of July there would be a downscheduling of MDMA for the specific indication of post-traumatic stress disorder and psilocybin for the specific indication of treatment-resistant depression. The last mention is very intriguing because actually very little data on treatment-resistant depression is with psilocybin. Depression, end-of-life depression, anxiety has much stronger evidence. So there's a lot of sort of cockeyed things around the whole thing. So what that means is that from a Schedule 9, it'll become a Schedule 8 for those particular disorders in that particular context and has to be prescribed by a psychiatrist who is a fellow of the college and who is authorized under the authorized prescriber scheme. And there's also a stipulation about oversight of by an ethics, human research ethics committee. Exact shape and form of that is not actually very clear. And then exactly who can provide the therapy and what the training is and everything else remains also a little bit up in the air.
Thank you, David. And Lynette, I would be very interested to hear, I'm sure everybody would as well, what the sort of view on from outside of what is occurring here in Australia.
Yeah, I think probably similar to what you said, Dr. Kessel, that at least in many of the conversations I'm having, you know, that on the one hand, I think there's a lot of excitement and a lot of interest and a lot of sort of, woohoo, you know, look at Australia go, because on the side where I think there is urgent need to be expanding and advancing interventions that seem to have potential to really lead to therapeutic benefit. From my perspective, we have a mental health crisis unlike anything we've really dealt with before, and we are desperate for something to work for that multitude of people who are not finding benefit from SSRIs or not ready to engage in, you know, talk therapy or these sorts of things. So on the one hand, I think there's a lot of excitement that there is very much mounting evidence that MDMA and psilocybin are safe and effective and, you know, that we need to be rolling these out. I think on the other side of that, though, is the concern or the curiosity of how will this actually roll out in a way that doesn't perhaps have unintended consequences. Certainly, I think that it's useful that it's not the sort of patchwork approach. Certainly in the U.S. right now, there's this patchwork approach of things happening where states have sort of gone around and done their own thing. Some states are completely decriminalizing. Some states, you know, are doing all sorts of things with cannabis, with psilocybin, with these sorts of things. And so it's sort of unknown exactly what that will look like, what the implications will be. I think, though, certainly a couple of very significant challenges or things from an outside perspective looking in are really just how is this going to work in the existing medical model? You know, these interventions are very time intensive, very resource intensive, both in terms of requiring providers that, you know, as you said, have a certain level of education. This isn't something that we're just going to be hiring people fresh out of uni to go and sit with somebody all day. But considering, you know, if you and I were going to see a patient together, that's obviously wildly different than what our usual practice would look like. I think most of the time a patient's going to see a psychologist, a social worker, somebody for a maximum of an hour. Psychiatrists for medication management, at least in the U.S., are often 15 minutes, 30-minute sessions. And to imagine two of us spending 6, 8, 10 hours a day with one patient, on the one hand, that's lovely, and I do think that's where part of the magic, if you will, pun intended, of the magic of those interventions works. On the other hand, how do we possibly make that scalable? How do we possibly continue to meet the needs of the patients that we have while also either taking two providers completely offline for a day for one patient or taking people to get trained to then have more people who can do this? I think that's a huge bottleneck. How do we train people and who do we decide is appropriate to train? Certainly from the scalability perspective, could we have one of those people be PhD level or an MD or something, and the other be perhaps fresh out of uni or have some sort of training? I think that's a huge piece. I think, though, the other piece is just generally the logistics of not yet having all of that data of, are there best practices in terms of dosing? Are there best practices in terms of what the intervention may look like? How do we best leverage these interventions for longer term? The long-term follow-up data is relatively limited for MDMA, for psilocybin, for any of these things. Yeah, I think there's very mixed reviews, certainly for what's happening in Australia, as well as very much the patchwork that's happening in the US and kind of across the world. I think we're seeing a bit of a patchwork that, on the one hand, is very exciting, and on the other hand, I think certainly has cause for concern.
Yeah, if I can pick up on a couple of those points. I mean, I think, so listeners understand the intensity of the therapeutic intervention which is entailed here. The usual recommendation is a dyadic approach. That's the therapists working in a dyad. As you said, we preference that at least one of those individuals would be a medical person. One of those individuals would be the same gender as the patient for various reasons. And there's a number of sessions which are preparatory and getting people and the dyad ready to work together in the actual dosing session. Then two or three dosing sessions, which, as you say, you know, are 6 to 8 hours, and somebody's with them all the time. And then, and I don't know what your comments would be about this, but our feeling is that the integration sessions haven't really been very well articulated exactly what they need and require. And I think we're going to see that as well. So, as you say, incredible amount of time, not to say that it's not worthwhile and it's not well deployed time, but certainly within the funding structures in Australia, there is no precedent. So one of the other concerns from the sort of social perspective is that this will be a hugely expensive, you know, $20,000 or so has been mooted as a sort of amount, which will preclude most of the population. So it becomes rich person's intervention. So those are other issues, yeah.
And I think that piece is certainly one of the primary concerns are those issues of access and equity. Even assuming we have some great means of training therapists and understanding how to fit this in, that it is wildly expensive. You know, certainly in the US, I often say that I think ketamine has sort of served a bit as the poster child for all of the things that we do not want to have happen with the rollout of psilocybin and MDMA, just that it is a bit of the Wild West in terms of not having clear guidance, at least over IV ketamine, how to administer that, what doses, you know, any of these things. Certainly ketamine also has the limitation of not necessarily having any guidance around psychotherapy, no psychotherapy, what that looks like. But it's so expensive that either it's only a, you know, 1% of the population is accessing it, or people are going into significant debt to get it, which then is an added stressor to whatever they were already dealing with to lead them there. That, yeah, I think that's a huge concern.
So that's an interesting perspective, what you would not want to see happen with psilocybin and MDMA. Do you want to just expand a little bit more on that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, certainly in my work in this small 501c3 that we formed, myself, a retired three-star general and an attorney, really have focused so much specifically on veteran community. That's where a lot of us have really focused a lot of our efforts and our thoughts around here. You know, that there are so many individuals who are desperate, really, for something that will help, something that will have therapeutic benefit. And veterans are very much that population. Many of them do not find significant therapeutic benefit from traditionally available interventions. And so there is that, you know, they have been a very profound advocacy group within the U.S. and elsewhere. And as we think about, you know, whether it's going to the VA or going to community clinics, that level of desperation, if you're told either, okay, MDMA, psilocybin, get approval, whether from the TGA here in Australia or the FDA in the U.S., I think patients will be probably quite literally lining up at their provider's office saying, I either just heard about it or I've been hearing about it. Sign me up. When do I get it? Let's start right away. And I think there's such a bottleneck that there is a lot of danger in the answer being check back with us in 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever, when we actually have our providers trained and we have all of the various bits of bureaucracy worked out, you know, that never, even if it's a brand new SSRI gets rolled out, that's generally not something that gets approved today and tomorrow everything's worked out perfectly to be prescribing it. And again, these are so much different and so much more time intensive and just such a different platform that I think there's a lot of concern both in the access and equity piece, the bottleneck and time delay, but also in that desperation that we know that that adage, desperate times call for desperate measures. Are people going to be pushed to feeling that they cannot wait? So then using recreationally, you know, trying to find someone that they can get ketamine from, get psilocybin from, get MDMA from, and then use perhaps not in the best of circumstances. Or certainly what we see in the U.S. a lot is people leaving the country, those who either work through one of the organizations that is funding, again, this is mostly veterans, funding people to leave the country, or people, you know, finding a friend who's maybe growing these in their basement or something. And, you know, I think they're, again, as you nicely highlighted, these are often incredibly intense, challenging experiences people have. And if you're just doing that without appropriate support or really doing that without any support, perhaps, that is where sometimes people have poorer outcomes. And certainly, I think, to your comment of having this blow up in our face, you know, that there is such potential here, and I think it will be so devastating for so many reasons if we don't navigate this in a way that lets us actually leverage the incredible opportunity that these interventions do provide us.
A couple of things you've touched on there. One is selection and determining who will likely do well and who will do not so well. And if you look at pretty much all these studies, the number of people, so-called eligibles, is massive. And then the way it's actually drilled down to who eventually gets into the trials is actually rather obscure and an inexact art. And from our own work, we've really struggled with that. You know, what would be a contraindication? Well, we have the usual contraindications of having an active psychotic disorder or a family history of schizophrenia or whatever, or bipolar 1 disorder. But beyond that, it's actually quite difficult. So one thing which has come up for us has been trauma background. So trauma is very common in the backgrounds of people with severe mood disorders and PTSD, of course. So that can't be an exclusion, but how you actually integrate that. And I really want to just reemphasize what you said about the experience, the dosing experience itself, because I think literature does not emphasize this enough. It seems, well, you know, just a nice experience and sit around and listen to some music and so forth and get supported. Well, actually, you know, we've actually found some people have very, very challenging dosing experiences. And unless you have people who are properly trained and properly supported to be able to deal with that and have a pre-prepared plan with the patient, it really can go nastily wrong. So all of these caveats need to be brought in.
I hope that you're enjoying this podcast. If you have a topic suggestion or would like to participate in a future episode of Psych Matters, we'd love to hear from you. Please contact us by email at psychmatters.feedback@ranzcp.org.
So Lynette, if you were working in Australia and you were going to set up a clinical service, what would that look like?
I mean, I suppose best case scenario, I would have been thinking about this 2 to 3 to 5 years ago, you know, seeing these things, the research mounting, hearing all of these conversations and thinking, okay, I need to start training my staff. I need to start thinking about how would this actually integrate into either the ketamine service maybe I have or the folks who are already providing psychotherapy or just if I have people prescribing SSRIs. Because I do think, again, that it's such a paradigm shift that I think that's a piece that also is a little bit missing, that, you know, the way clinical trials are structured, we have all of those pristine bits of data, right, where it's only depression or only PTSD, and we've taken everybody off of their medication, and you can't have TBI, and you're not supposed to be suicidal and any of these things. But generally, those are not the patients who really are coming into our offices saying, hey, I've tried everything, and I need sort of the Hail Mary pass here. So I think really trying to characterize and conceptualize how do you be most inclusive, while being safe. There was a review recently that came out that talked about maybe we don't need to be taking people off of all of their medications, at least the serotonergic ones, for psilocybin, because it seems like that's not a significant risk for serotonin toxicity. MAOIs, maybe, yes. But these kinds of things, how do we figure those things out after we're already in the midst of it, is not the best time to be figuring those things out. I suppose I wish I had a very good, straightforward answer for that. I think it would have to be a blend of continuing to provide whatever services you're providing while also getting your therapists trained, your prescribers trained for what does this new intervention look like. And doing, I think, sort of simultaneously trying to do a bit of program evaluation and a bit of clinical service and a bit of research at the same time to sort of see where those bottlenecks are in real time, which, again, is not always the best approach, sort of learning by doing. But I think for all of us, that's where we are. I think this resurgence of investigation in psychedelic medicines has been coming for a very long time, but it's only been relatively recently, I think, that most any of the countries across the world are saying, oh God, like we need to actually be doing this. It's here. And I think there is a bit of hesitancy to kind of sit back and say, I don't want to be the first one to jump in. Let's see what other people do, and then we can see what their successes were and what their failures were, and we'll try to do better. I don't know, other than trying to put your best foot forward, trying to figure out how to balance the ongoing care with the training of folks, how to balance the issues around coverage for finances, all
Yeah, and also
things.
lots of different views and opinions. I mean, Richard is the chair of the psychedelics group in our college, trying to pull these ideas together. And I think it's fair to say he has to be a bit saintly and non-partisan and try and drive through some very big opinions, both within the group, and that's, nice that we've had that opportunity to discuss, but also outside. So getting all of those inputs from people has been very interesting, and people certainly have views and opinions from very liberal approaches where, everyone should have this opportunity and don't need much regulation, to people saying it was all a very bad idea and we should take a massive step back from it. The truth is, we are facing this, that whether we like it or not, certainly I think the opportunity to help some patients who are really struggling, continue to struggle, is obviously welcome. But I think you've highlighted a whole lot of points which we have not dealt with adequately. So taking the stance that safety must be the first priority. And the other bit which I liked about what you said was the imperatives around ongoing research and evaluation. So, we really need a funded mechanism to establish a proper registry of patients, issues about confidentiality and so forth, but being able to track those. And also, Richard, your fine work as chairing this group, I think, starts a sort of network of individuals who, arguably we should look at beyond just psychiatrists, but having such a network of people and practitioners and being able to share resources and share thoughts and ideas about it. And just the last bit on that is, and I don't know whether you want to comment on this, Lynette, but the impact on therapists, I think, should also not be underestimated. So we've had some therapists who have found this also extremely challenging for their own reasons, and how that is done and how that is supported and so forth and so on hasn't been, peer support is sort of part of what we're mandated to do as psychiatrists, and we have meetings to support each other, but this is different, and some of it gets to the very core of your own internal hurts and issues.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that I would comment on. To that piece, I think I had a couple of folks that I know who have gone through these interventions who say it feels like 6 months of trauma-focused work in a day. And certainly as the patient, that's wildly intensive. But also, yeah, absolutely, as the therapist, that's wildly intensive. To sit with someone all day with really only a quick bathroom break and you sort of eat your sandwich in the corner, like to go through 6 months of whether it's trauma, depression, whatever it is, these are very intensive experiences. And yeah, it's incredibly challenging for the providers as well. And I think that certainly for most providers, at least in either psychologists or psychiatry, the interventions themselves are rather different from what most of us were taught, you know, that it's sort of this blend of supportive care, a bit of body work, a bit of breath work, a bit of, you know, these different things, which again, I think is probably where a lot of the benefit comes from. And it's very much a learning curve for most providers, that it's not something you just walk into and are like, oh, I am perfectly comfortable doing all of this.
Well, that's interesting because, and again, Richard, you might comment, but, you know, some people are saying, well, you know, we're all trained in, as psychiatrists, we have training in psychotherapy, therefore we should be able to do this. And it's just not, is not like that. And it doesn't, I don't think our training prepares us very well for it.
Well, that was going to be my next question, really, is one of the big undefineds that I see in this is what is the right sort of therapy that to go along with the psychedelic?
I think that's something that hasn't really been answered, you know, very definitively on the one hand. And on the other hand, I guess I, from a precision medicine perspective, I don't think there will be the one perfect intervention to go with it, you know, that people are different, trauma is different, depression is different. And so saying, you know, you will have psilocybin protocol, period, probably is not the best approach either. That I do think that's something positive about the way that these have been put forward is that it is relatively non-directive, supportive care. And those preparation sessions at the beginning really are intended to talk through expectations and all of these things. But I think also to build that rapport, build that trust between patient and therapists, but really conceptualize what is it that we're hoping to do here? What is it that we want to be working on? What is it that we would hope to see shift in this session? And then, of course, the dosing day, working through some of those things as they come up. And then, importantly, those integration sessions, trying our best to come together and, of course, talking through whatever the actual experience of the drugs were and these sorts of things and trying to move forward in a way with, you know, whatever does come up in those sessions, processing through that, but also I think very importantly, working with patients from beginning to end, that this is not a one and done, this is not the miracle cure, golden bullet, that there's still significant work that has to be done after those sessions, after the integration. And, you know, I think the hype and the sort of misinformation that a lot of people have of, oh, I'll go and do this, you know, have my dosing and my integration, and then, the clouds will part and everything will be great. That's not the reality. You know, even for folks who do have a very robust experience, they still have to do their own work to continue that, to maintain that. And I think some people that may be that they then are at a point where they can go and meaningfully engage in psychotherapy, whether that's something like PE or CPT, you know, the trauma-focused treatments that perhaps they weren't at a stage they really could do before. Or, you know, certainly I know some folks who have gone through and started or restarted an SSRI afterwards and found that it took off enough of the edge and kind of helped maintain those benefits afterwards. I think certainly those are important pieces. Something else I wanted to comment on very briefly that I certainly we talk a lot about in some of our conversations around policy and around, you know, all of these things is sort of the risk-benefit analysis of the, you know, the safety first, I think absolutely is a critical piece. We don't want to be causing any harm. And I think perhaps asking ourselves, in what ways do we cause harm and in what ways are there unintended consequences or unintended harms? And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, as we think about these psychedelic medicines and assisted therapies rolling out, and certainly I think rightful concern around, well, there's perhaps limited data for some indications or there's small sample sizes or what about the blinding or, you know, any of these questions that we also have to ask ourselves, what about not pursuing these things? Because we know that people are struggling, we know that people are suffering, we know that people are dying, whether that is by suicide, by addiction, by other things. And sort of where do we find that balance between, yes, we need to continue building that body of research, that body of evidence, whether that's around dosing, which psychotherapy to use, can we do these in group formats, can we not, how do we stack interventions, any of those things, while also figuring out how do we try to promote wellness and life now.
So, David, one of the things that's really taken me by surprise, because not really being in this field before, is just the intense interest from other psychiatrists. So we run a webinar on psychedelics. Normally, webinar, we get sort of 50, 60 people. We run a webinar on psychedelics, and we get 1,000 psychiatrists signing up to come. We're here at the 2023 Congress. There was a session on psychedelics, which I was going to go along to. The room was absolutely full with people queuing out the door. David, what's your advice to psychiatrists that are thinking about this? I mean, maybe it's just curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is curiosity. And I mean, you know, there's something rather alluring about the whole psychedelic space and the mystique and the magic and the, I suppose a lot of us are throwback hippies on some level or whatever. So there's all of that. And then there is the couching of it, which I think has been concerning, and the sort of sell to the public. And that's been notable in Australia and quite damaging, I think, in terms of raising expectations and unrealistic expectations, and also in the same context, damning psychiatry and psychiatrists. So that has been an unhelpful dialogue. But in terms of your specific question, Richard, you know, I think it's great that we're excited. It's great that we want better treatments for our patients. I think people genuinely want to know, and they want to know proper things about the actual evidence base and the actual limitations of that evidence and the actual implications for clinical practice. I was interested that the webinar, which is also very strongly attended from the TGA, the then chair, John Skerritt, said, oh, we don't wish for there to be lots of these psychedelic clinics popping up everywhere. But why would he say that? What does that actually mean? I mean, that they actually want them, but they don't want them. And if they're not done in clinics where people can actually have a proper set of processes and a proper setup and proper safety and proper training and proper holding environment for the patient and for the staff and everything else, how is it going to be done? You're not going to, like, you know, as a jobbing psychiatrist, once a month I'll dose somebody with psilocybin. That would be silly and dangerous. On the other side, how are people going to actually do this if that's their main endeavor, 2 days of every week, 3 days of every week or whatever, to just doing dosing? That's jolly difficult to sustain. So people do want to know some answers. Of course, as the chair of the group, you're going to provide all of those, Richard, and give us perfect guidance. No, without being facetious, I think the engagement of our discipline and other people with investment in this is very important, and that we continually monitor what we're doing, how it's going, how we can refine our views. Because I think you'll agree, this initial foray into trying to pull together a guideline, it's not going to be perfect. You know, it'll be undoubtedly well-intentioned. It'll be hopefully helpful enough, but it would need to be refined in an ongoing way. So I think people are invested in that process to some degree as well.
Well, thank you for your time, Lynette and David. It's been a really interesting conversation today. I'm sure we're going to have more conversations about psychedelics as time goes on.
I think we might.
Yes. And as David says, that, you know, the college is going to be publishing our initial guidance on this well in time for the 1st of July. And I think we're all going to just observe very carefully what happens and adjust, refine, and think about this more as the field emerges here in Australia. Anyway, Lynette, David, thank you very much for today.
Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Psych Matters. Feel free to share it with others and keep an eye out for future episodes. Psych Matters is produced by the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists.